Hello and welcome to the Snow Christensen and Martineau Counselor's Corner, a podcast dedicated to keeping you up to speed with the ever-changing legal landscape. This podcast is brought to you by Snow Christensen and Martineau, a full-service law firm located here in Salt Lake City that has been serving clients for over 125 years.
Hey everybody, this is Robert Denny at the law firm of Snow Christensen and Martineau. I'm a shareholder here, and a significant portion of my practice is devoted to defending other lawyers who are being sued for malpractice or who are facing disciplinary action before the Utah State Bar. And my presentation here today is going to focus on 10 traps for the unwary to hopefully help other lawyers out there avoid a malpractice action and avoid potential disciplinary action as well. And much of the stuff I'm talking about today is stuff we've all heard before, but hopefully is a nice refresher, because if we get busy, sometimes we forget to do what we're supposed to do. And I'm hoping that this presentation will provide a few good tips and reminders to help you avoid a malpractice suit or a disciplinary action down the road. Before digging into that, I wanted to notice one of the common threads that runs through many of the disciplinary actions that are presented before the Utah State Bar's Office of Professional Conduct, and that's communication. Communication is critical. I highly recommend taking a look at Rule 1.4 of the Utah Rules of Professional Responsibility just as a refresher to make sure that you're doing everything you need to do to communicate critical information to your clients. With that, let's dig into the 10 traps for the unwary to hopefully help you avoid a malpractice action or disciplinary action in the future. Number 10 is failing to document crucial decisions. One thing we see over and over again is lawyers who have made a decision in a case a couple years earlier, their client has now sought the services of an attorney, they're going back and reviewing what this lawyer did, a third party reviewing what the lawyer did for their client, and there's no documentation to back up why they took this path or why they took that path. And with a third party reviewing the case years down the road, it's very easy to point out, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And that makes it essential to write down why you're making specific decisions, why you're making strategic choices. There are several reasons for that. In addition for creating a paper trail down the road, it helps to educate the client. It gives the client a basis for understanding why you're doing what you're doing. And when you send these communications to the client documenting critical decisions, have the client acknowledge that they've received it, that they understand it, and that they want to go forward with it. That way, there's no confusion down the road that this is a path that you and your client agreed to. Documenting critical decisions serves a couple other purposes as well. It keeps you sharper. It makes you put down in writing why you're choosing a particular path, the pros and cons of that path, and it ultimately makes you a better lawyer. One thing that we often notice in mock trials that we do and in trials that we've seen is that if the lawyer didn't write it down, it didn't happen. So the lawyer may have had the best of intentions, may have called the client and said, hey, let's do this road. The client says, sure, that sounds great. But again, if the decision is not documented, jurors looking at this years down the road are going to say, well, lawyers write down everything. If this really would have happened, how the lawyer is saying it happened, they would have written it down. Now, one cause for concern the lawyers may have with documenting, you know, every critical decision in the case is, you know, clients may get frustrated. They may say, hey, we just talked about this. Why do you need to write this long letter, which, you know, is clearly a CYA letter? And the reason that it's important is there may be some client irritation if you're documenting every decision and saying, we're doing this because of this, you agreed to X. And, you know, really, I encourage attorneys to take kind of a long view of this. Documenting the decisions is going to benefit both client and lawyer in the long run. Even if there's no malpractice or disciplinary action arising from representation, it ultimately helps both parties to understand where you're going. And if problems arise in the future, to look back and say, okay, here's why we did X. And it helps both parties understand what's going on much, much better. Moving on to trap number 9, getting involved with clients' business interests. Now, this is something that happens very, very often. And it's really important to take a look at Rule 1.8, which details current client conflict of interest rules. Now, Rule 1.8 says, it says, a lawyer shall not enter into a business transaction with a client or knowingly acquire an ownership, possessory, security, or other pecuniary interest adverse to a client unless the transition in terms in which the lawyer acquires the interest are fair and reasonable to the client and are fully disclosed and transmitted in writing in a manner that can be reasonably understood by the client. The client is advised in writing of the desirability of seeking and is given a reasonable opportunity to seek the advice of independent legal counsel on the transaction, and the client gives informed consent in a writing signed by the client to the essential terms of the transaction and the lawyer's role in the transaction, including whether the lawyer is representing the client in the transaction. And in going through this rule, it's important to take a close understanding of what this actually involved. It's not limited to a lawyer getting involved with the business transaction related to the specific transaction that the lawyer is assisting the client with. As comment 1-2, this rule explains, the requirement of paragraph A must be met even when the transaction is not closely related to the subject matter of the representation, as when a lawyer drafting a will for a client learns the client needs money for unrelated expenses and offers to make a loan to the client. I think a little bit of clarification there is important because, you know, if you're representing a client in a litigation matter, you know, with respect to one company, the same rule applies even if there's a different investment with some different parties. You still need to make sure that you're following the rules set out in Rule 1.8. Moving on to trap number 8, missing deadlines or missing court appearances. This seems like an easy one to avoid, but it happens time and time again where an attorney misses a deadline or misses the statute of limitations. And there are a few easy fixes to this and a few tidbits of advice for how to make sure that you don't miss deadlines or miss court appearances. When you receive a motion on your desk or receive it via email, even if you don't have time to review the substance of that motion, of that filing, or at the immediate time that it hits your desk, make sure that you immediately address the deadline, even if you can't meet the substance. One practice that I employ to make sure that I don't miss deadlines is redundancy. My partner Keith Call calls this the triple play. Make sure it's on your calendar, make sure it's on a separate task list, and then make sure it's on the firm's docketing system. For smaller practices, you know, you may not have a formal docketing system, but make sure that there is a way, at least some sort of redundancy, to make sure that you have it docketed, that you have it calendared in multiple places. Periodically review your calendar once a week at the very least, just to make sure that there aren't any deadlines sneaking up on you, or to make sure that you don't notice that you have a deadline at 11:59 the day that it's due. Couple other pointers. Don't necessarily believe the client on the deadline. Do your due diligence. Double check the client. Make sure that any deadline that they're telling you is correct, because, you know, we love our clients, but sometimes they do get dates incorrect. Double check those deadlines. Don't believe the clerk as well. You know, make sure that you're double checking deadlines as much as you can, because it's something that's easy to avoid, but something that's also often missed. Moving on to trap number 7, representation of friends and acquaintances. We've all been there. We're the attorney in the friend group, in our group of acquaintances. Someone comes to us and says, hey, can you help me out with this matter? It's pretty small. I think it should be pretty easy. And out of a sense of obligation, a lawyer may say, sure, that's not my typical practice area, but I can help you out with this one little thing. I can help you draft a will, even though I generally do corporate restructurings or litigation. Just be very careful with representation of friends and acquaintances. Make sure that when you're representing friends or acquaintances, that the area of practice is within your competence. If not, you know, seek some additional help from an additional who practices regularly in that area. Additionally, make sure that you don't treat these friends and acquaintance clients as any differently than you do your ordinary clients. It's easy to, you know, put something off because, oh, that's my friend, that's my acquaintance, he'll understand if I don't get to it this week. It's important to make sure you stay on top of these friends and acquaintance clients just like you do any other client. Because if you don't and things turn south, there's a likelihood you may be facing a malpractice lawsuit or a bar complaint. Moving on to trap number six, failing to acknowledge mistakes. So, you know, it's tough to admit when we're wrong. Lawyers, like everybody else, make mistakes. In the legal profession, it can be a little bit more serious sometimes. And we don't like to admit that we've done something that we shouldn't have, or that we've overlooked a deadline, that we've overlooked a statute. When these mistakes happen, it's important not to hide the facts from your client. And in particular here, I think Rule 1.4 of the Utah Rules of Professional Conduct is particularly informative. Rule 1.4 provides that a lawyer shall promptly inform the client of any decision or circumstance with respect to which the client's informed consent is required by these rules. The lawyer must reasonably consult with the client about the means which the client's objectives are to be accomplished. The lawyer must keep the client reasonably informed about the status of the matter. The lawyer must promptly comply with reasonable requests for information. And the lawyer must consult with the client about any relevant limitation on the lawyer's conduct when the lawyer knows the client expects assistance not permitted by rules of professional conduct or other law. Additionally, a lawyer shall explain a matter to the extent reasonably necessary to permit the client to make informed decisions regarding the representation. Comment 7 is particularly apt here with respect to mistakes. Comment 7 says a lawyer may not withhold information to serve the lawyer's own interest or convenience, or the interest or convenience of another person. So, bottom line, if you make a mistake, it's critical to sit back, think about how is this mistake going to impact the case. If it's going to have a significant impact, or even a minimal impact, depending on the circumstances, it's important that you let the client know how it's going to affect the rep moving forward. We often hear stories about lawyers who, you know, missed a deadline or made some other mistake, and they try and fix it themselves before contacting the client, or they try and fix it themselves without letting the client know what's going on. And oftentimes it goes south. They can't fix the issue. It has a snowball effect and becomes much, much worse than it otherwise would have been if the lawyer had involved their client in the situation at a much earlier date. In acknowledging mistakes, though, it's important to recognize that there may be restrictions on what the lawyer can say pursuant to any malpractice insurance policies. And, you know, be careful with admitting mistakes. We say, you know, admit your mistakes, make sure you comply with Rule 1.4. At the same time, if a mistake is made, consider alerting firm counsel or the loss prevention partner immediately, even if it seems like an easy fix. Moving on to trap number 5, casual internal communications. So about 8 years ago, there was a pretty big controversy regarding a fee dispute issue relating to DLA Piper and one of its clients. And there were a few emails exchanged that were probably intended to be casual, you know, probably not intended to be serious, you know, giving these guys the benefit of the doubt, but they looked very, very bad in hindsight. The first email in the chain was, quote, "I hear we are already $200,000 over our estimate. That's team DLA Piper," end quote. The next email was, quote, "What was our estimate? But Tim brought Vince in to work on the objection for whatever reason, and now Vince has random people working full-time on random research projects in standard Vince churn that bill baby mode. That bill shall know no limits." It goes without saying that this email and emails like it look very, very bad, especially if they're presented to a jury or other fact finder. The key takeaway here is be very circumspect when sending casual internal emails to your colleagues. We all like to joke around with our colleagues, and there's nothing wrong with that. But at the end of the day, emails don't necessarily convey the humor that we want them to. And so an email that may seem funny today may be Exhibit A in a lawsuit down the road. The key takeaway here is think about what you say in an email before you send it, and assume that every email you send is going to be presented before a judge and a jury. Moving on to trap number 4, collection of fees. Utah's Office of Professional Conduct has stated that its impression is that violations of Rule 1.5, which deals with the collection of fees, commonly arise from attorneys collecting fees without performing meaningful work. So if you have a client and they're not paying their bills, the first thing you want to ask yourself is, what work did we do for the client? Was that work meaningful? And what result did the client ultimately get? It's pretty typical that when a law firm sues a client for a collection of fees, that the client ultimately counterclaims for malpractice. So before rushing out to file a lawsuit to collect fees or performing other collections actions, really take a step back. You know, is this something you can write off? Consider having one of your other partners or outside counsel take a review of the case, take a review of the fees that were charged in that case, and see what their impressions are of it. Does it seem reasonable? Is there any reason for why the client would be dissatisfied with your work and why they're not paying you? These are issues that may be fairly easy for, you know, a partner or outside counsel to see, and may provide litigants who are really enmeshed in the case some guidance on issues they're just not noticing because they're so involved in the case. A couple other considerations for how to avoid fees becoming an issue in the first place. Keep up on billing. If a client isn't paying their bills, address it with the client immediately before it becomes an issue where you need to think about pursuing collection actions or filing a lawsuit. Additionally, make sure to communicate effectively with your clients. If you've done a budget and there are parts of the litigation that you simply can't control that are increasing the budget, let your client know that the budget is going to be increased. Let them know why. Keep them apprised of the case. Again, this goes back to Rule 1.4. Keep your client up to date as to fees, understand what their expectations are, and hopefully you can avoid problems before they arise. Moving on to trap number 3, attempting to take on a case with a minimal budget. So for instance, say someone comes to you and they say, I've got this trade secret case, I can't pay you a lot of money. You take a look at the case and think it's gonna cost $1 million to prosecute it. The client says, I have 10,000. In situations like that, it's not necessarily inappropriate to represent the client, but you wanna make sure that the client has an understanding of what they're going to miss out on by not paying for the full gamut of legal services that are necessary for the case. And ultimately, this goes back to the topic that we discussed earlier on documenting crucial decisions. If the client doesn't want to pay for you to go to every deposition, if the client doesn't want you to respond to certain motions, it's essential that you get those decisions in writing, and even consider putting them there in your initial engagement letter, specifically defining what your scope of representation is going to be, and consider entering into a limited scope representation. This may be particularly appropriate if the client wants you to attend one deposition but not others, wants you to file one motion but doesn't want you to respond to others, because that way the responsibilities that you owe to the client are made clear, they're upfront to everybody, and if someone is to look at the case years down the road, it'll be clear why you were doing what you were doing, that the client understood the limitations of the representation that they were paying for. Moving on to trap number 2, conflicts of interest. In addressing conflicts of interest, it's really important to be well-versed with the conflict of interest rules in the Utah Rules of Professional Conduct, starting at 1.7. And with an understanding of those rules, establishing a system of procedures so you can identify conflicts of interest before they arise. A few standard procedures that you may want to consider implementing are: when you receive a call from a potential new client, before you get any information regarding what their case is about, get the names of all parties involved, run them through your conflict system, and make sure there's not a conflict. Once you have that information, you're in a much better position to ensure that you don't have a conflict that's going to cause issues later on down the road. At larger firms, you know, there are probably a number of other more detailed conflicts checks that you want to do. Here at our firm, after we run a name through the conflict system, we send a list out through every attorney, every paralegal, staff members of the firm, identifying new clients, adverse clients, clients that are not adverse but that may become adverse in the future, just so if something wasn't picked up in our standard conflict search, someone may pick up on it through a review of the conflict searches that are being run for that particular day. Additionally, this goes back to casual communications. Take conflicts of interest seriously. You know, there have been a number of cases where there have been cavalier statements about conflicts of interest. Sure, they might be funny at the time, but they're not funny years down the road when a third party is reviewing them and the humor simply doesn't come across. Even after a case has passed the initial conflict search, make sure that you're following up with your cases. If there are new facts that arise, if new parties are added to your case, run a conflicts check to make sure that there aren't any issues that are arising. Do you need to issue a third-party subpoena in your case? Make sure to run a conflicts check before then to make sure that you're not subpoenaing information from your own clients. And importantly, when representing corporations, LLCs, or partnerships, be clear with the client who you're representing and what the scope of that representation is. Relationships grow, companies grow, and it's important to make sure that everybody is on the same page. And with respect to, you know, corporate clients, it's also important to make sure that the individual officers of the client understand that you do not represent them when that's the case. There's something called an implied attorney-client relationship here in Utah, and it's possible for an attorney-client relationship to arise even without written documentation if the client has a reasonable belief that you represent them as their lawyer. In the corporate context, it's critically important to let officers know that you don't represent them in their individual capacity. Again, document this, identify who the client is, who isn't the client, and make sure that everybody is on the same page. Moving on to trap number one, failing to communicate with your client. We've been discussing this for the entire podcast. Pay close attention to Rule 1.4, but the majority of complaints that the Utah State Bar receives about attorneys are failing to communicate with your client. These aren't difficult issues. You know, when you're busy, it may be hard to return a phone call to a client. It may be difficult to respond to every email, but it's something that we as lawyers need to keep up with. If you have a client that's calling you 4 or 5 times a day, that's obviously a difficult situation to address. Make sure to set expectations with that client appropriately and comply with Rule 1.4. Again, Rule 1.4 requires that lawyers promptly inform the client of any decision or circumstance with respect to which the client's informed consent is required. Reasonably consult with the client about the means which the client's objectives should be accomplished. Keep the client reasonably informed about the status of the matter. Promptly comply with reasonable requests for information. Consult with the client about any relevant limitation on the lawyer's conduct. The lawyer knows the client expects assistance not permitted by the rules of professional conduct or other law. And importantly, a lawyer shall explain a matter to the client reasonably necessary to permit the client to make informed decisions regarding the representation. So ultimately what this boils down to is it's hard to keep up with every email, keep up with every voice message, but it's important that the important issues regarding the case are communicated to the client. And it goes a long way in maintaining the client relationship to even when the client's calling you excessively to return that call, or at least set expectations to the client as to when you're going to be able to return their call or email. One of the other essential aspects of keeping clients, maintaining client communications is making sure that you're periodically updating the client. You know, maybe the client hasn't checked in with you in 2 to 3 months. Maybe they're waiting for an update from you. If a case is slow, if it's in a lull, provide periodic updates. If a case is busy, if it's hot, provide periodic updates to make sure that the client knows what's going on and knows how you're handling the case. Additionally, make sure the client understands the legal principles that you're dealing with in the case. You know, oftentimes I talk to lawyers and it seems like it's difficult for them to explain complex legal issues to me, another lawyer. Imagine what that's going to be like when they're trying to explain something complex to their client. Try to put complex legal issues into terms that are appropriate for the client. If it's an experienced legal issue, that's obvious. Experienced legal user is your client, obviously not going to be as much of an issue. But if you're dealing with someone who has very little experience with the process, make sure you even explain the basic stuff just to make sure that everyone is on the same page as to what's going on. Again, I recommend taking a close look at Rule 1.4 every couple months just to make sure that you understand the rules, understand that you're keeping your clients reasonably apprised of the case. And with that, that brings our podcast today on the 10 traps for the unwary to a close. I hope I provided some useful reminders, useful tidbits of information that you can provide in your practice, or they can use in your practice, rather. And if you have any questions on the topics that I've discussed here today, feel free to reach out to me. Again, my name is Robert Denny. You can find me at scmlaw.com. My email address is rdenny@scmlaw.com. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for coming to the Snow Christensen Martineau Counselor's Corner. Please join us next time.